Let's turn to the book of Genesis. And Genesis 13. We've been going through the book of Genesis. I know, before it just was pictures on a page, but now it's got the full drama of the pictures coming in. So, anyways, we've been going through the book of Genesis and considering then the book of beginnings. And recently, in the last 3 weeks, we've been looking at the life of Abraham and God's working through the life of Abraham. And last week, we looked at the encounter with Yahweh, but in the midst of looking at the call of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant and the encounter with Yahweh, we kind of skipped past, and I said we were at that point, the life of Lot and the encounter that Abraham and Lot's servants had with each other, and said we'd come back to that as we consider some lessons from the life of Lot. And we want to, as we look at the lessons from the life of Lot, I want to as well consider Abraham and his dealings with Lot and how he interacted with Lot in his life and the decisions that Lot was going to make. And because Lot's going to make some choices, and as there is to all choices, there are consequences. Whether, you know, a lot of times when we hear consequences, we always think, what? Bad. But, you know, all choices have consequences, whether they are bad or good. A lot of choices have good consequences. But we normally focus on the choices that have bad consequences, and so we're going to be considering those as well today. Because lessons from Lot, from the perspective of Lot itself, are not always good lessons. But there are positive lessons as well that we receive, that we look at from the life of Abraham, as Abraham has to deal with Lot and has to deal with what's going on. So first we want to start off with the choice. Now there are going to be numerous choices that Lot makes as we look at it, but they're all precipitated upon one choice. Now there is a choice that Lot made prior to the choice we're going to look at starting off today. Does anybody know what choice he made first that was a good choice? Say again. To go with Avram. That's right. When Avram left to go to Canaan, Lot chose to go with him. Now, we're not told why, we're not told how, but Lot went with him, okay? And so that was a good choice on Lot's part to go with Avram. But we're told in Genesis chapter 13 that as they go into the land, that God begins to bless Abram, and God begins to bless Lot, if you would, and he begins to bless their herds. And so we want to begin looking at chapter 13, look at verse 2, okay, and we'll start there. It says, Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and gold, and he went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first. And there Abram called upon the name of Yahweh. Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them, in that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. So, first we've got the situation. God's blessings were upon them, such that as they grew, they became too large to dwell together. Okay? Now, this is an important thing to think about. You know, we pray for God's blessings. We want to what? Grow. We want to have more things. But you know what? As we grow, not necessarily just as a church, you know, I'm not just thinking that way, but even individually, and I'm not talking about girth, I'm talking about just an influence and stuff like that. But as we grow in affluence as well, it presents other problems. You know, just think of us as a body. As we grow, you know, and, you know, there is going to be times if we don't move, or we don't get more property, or if we don't get a bigger facility, okay, then there's going to become issues. This room can only hold so many people. And then we'll have to make what? Decisions. Okay? There will be turmoil, a little bit of turmoil, as people come in and they can't find a place to sit. Some of you already struggle with that if you come in a little bit late. The solution to that is come in early. Anyways, so I joke about that as far as, you know, I wanted to get people to leave the front chairs, leave the front chairs empty. And you bring those in when people come in late, then you put the chairs down in front, you know? And then people don't like that. They like to get the chairs in the back, but see, if you leave the chairs in the back and they fill up and then you put the chairs up front, people don't like coming late. So anyways, there's always solutions to everything. So you come early, and then you don't have to worry about finding a chair. But as we get larger and larger, chair space becomes what? Very much more limited. That's exactly right. And then, though we can kind of move around and we can kind of adjust, at that point it's going to be kind of hard because then we're putting up folding chairs and we're trying to figure out where people are going to go. You know, it's not like we have opening, closing windows, so it's not like you can be Eutychus and, you know, even sit on the outside and fall and get hurt. And anyways, we'll have issues that we'll have to deal with, okay? And so, well, the same thing was happening with Avram and Lot. God was blessing them. They were increasing in their cattle and in their affluence, but the land was too small, if you would. The land wasn't able to contain them all. There wasn't potentially enough water for them all. So they had a situation. It needed a solution. Well, we come to this selection process that we're going to see in a moment that you all know from reading through this that God gives it. But in this selection process, what I want to look at is, first of all, Abram's desire. Abram says, verse 7, "And there was strife between the herdsmen of Aram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. And so Avram said to Lot, 'Please, let there be no strife between me and you.'" How would you define Avram's desire? He wanted there to be what? He wanted to be peace. He wanted to be unity among the brethren. Does that make sense? And I want to encourage you that that should always be our ultimate desire. Our ultimate desire should always be that there be unity within the body, that there be peace among the brethren, okay? And so not always is that the case, because many times we're going to see in a moment, okay, from the other side, is we want what? Well, we want what we want. We want our will to be done, not necessarily the will of the people, or the will, even better, the will of God. We want our will to be done. We want what we want and not what is best for the body. And so Avram wants what is best for everybody. He says, "Please, let there be no strife between me and you." But look at now how he determines in his desire that he believes that this is going to be best accomplished. He says, "Let there be no strife between me and you, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me." Separate from me? That sounds like a church split, doesn't it? There are times, if you would, for separation. Now, I don't believe that's in marriage, okay? I believe what God has put together, let not man put asunder. So there are some who would take this analogy and they would apply it then even to marriages. I don't believe it applies to marriages. But this is clearly talking about brethren, talking about people together, who desire to keep what? Peace in unity. But they're recognizing, if you would, Abram is recognizing what the actual cause is of it. And it's not a cause by just bitterness that's going on here. Bitterness is coming, but it's actually caused by the blessings of God. He recognizes the situation. The land can't hold us both. Something has to be done. You know, it's not like we're going to have two separate waterings, two separate services, you get it? You know, we're not going to have two separate waterings because still it's not what? It's not able to do it. And so Avram turns to Lot and basically says, we need to separate. We need to divide. We need to go separate ways so there's no what? Discord between us. The issue is bigger than who gets this piece of property. You get it? The issue is we want unity. And so look what he says to him. An incredible, incredible thing that he says. "Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will go to the left." Powerful, powerful statement here. Unto whom was the promise of God made? Avram, Abraham. What was the promise? The land. "Unto you and your descendants I will give this land." He didn't say, "Unto you and your kin I will give the land," but "unto you and your descendants." But Avram says to Lot, he says, "Look, I understand that unity and peace is so important here, so here's what I'm going to say to you. You choose. If you say, I'm staying, then I'll go. If you say, I'll go, I'll stay. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right." In other words, I'm going to give you the what? I'm going to give you the choice. I am extending to you the honor of choosing where you want to go. Does that make sense? I mean, how many of you have ever seen a church or been involved in a church split where one side said to the other side, "I'll give preference to you"? But that's the idea. That's the model that comes. I'll give the preference to you because my ultimate desire is the kingdom of God. Is the ultimate desire is the unity and peace of the brethren. And so for the unity of the brethren, for the peace of the brethren, you decide. We need to separate, so I will move away from you. If you want this part, then I'll go to the next part. If you want that part, then I'll go to this part. Well, that's Abram's desire. But the next thing we see is Lot's decision. Well, Lot's decision has within it a couple determiners here. And you see the first one coming spinning in there. It's his faulty motivation. His faulty motivation for his decision process. How does Lot make the decision of where he's going to go? By his eyes. That's exactly right. According to the lusts of the world, if you would. So Lot then, verse 10, says, Lot lifted up his eyes. He saw all the plain of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before Yahweh destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Yahweh, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. So his faulty motivation, first of all, is he did not consider it according to spiritual things. And if you looked at Facebook yesterday, I kind of put a little note out there that how many, I get tired of all the pontifications of political things on Facebook and people spewing out opinions and all. But all these opinions and questions that I keep seeing on Facebook all basically boil down to a financial, political, and racial rhetoric. You know, people are making decisions based upon economics. They're making decisions based upon national and world politics. They're making decisions based upon racial decisions. You know, there are some who decide making decisions regardless of what they think of other things. They're going to make a decision because of racial decisions. And those are all fully 100% wrong for those who are called by God's name. Our decisions solely, wholly, ought to be focused upon spiritual qualifications. Spiritual. Lot doesn't do that. Lot doesn't go out seeking God's face. He doesn't want God's will. What Lot does is he looks out, according to his eyes, he looks into the world and he says, this looks good from the world's perspective. He looks down and he says, man, that plain is well watered. It's going to be good for my what? For my flocks. He's looking at it from the perspective of the world, from what will help him out financially. But it's not just faulty motivation, it's selfish motivation. Well, how do I get to that? Well, even though he had faulty motivation, accept the motivation for a moment. Lot looks at it, and he determines what is best. Understand faulty motivation, but he determined what was best, right? Then what did he do? He took it. He didn't look at it and say, well, that's really the best, choicest piece of pie, and so I'm going to leave it for you. I'll take this little scrawny one. No, no. He looked at the pie, and he said, that one has hardly any cherries in it. This one is chock full. Or he looked at the pepperoni pizza. You know how they do sometimes. They're not really careful where they put it. And this piece of pepperoni pizza has tons of pepperonis all over, and this one has got like two on it. And so he looked at the pepperoni pizza, and he says, I want this piece. He wanted the best. He may have been wrong, he may have been faulty in how he was assessing in his motivations, but take that for granted, what he assessed to be the best, he what? He took. Do you know what? This is exactly how most church splits occur. There's faulty motivation, because they're not seeking God's face, they're looking at what they think is best from the world's perspective, and then what happens? And then they say, I want it done my way. And no one's willing to what? Back down. No one's willing to compromise. No one's willing to back down. No one's willing to go and pray about it and change their opinion on it. Because everybody wants what they want. I want to be cautious. I mean, I'm not saying we're there. I'm not even worried about that at this moment. But you know what? As God blesses us, I've been in part of that. You know, we went from 70 to 180. And when we got that large, all of a sudden, you know what? There were issues. So I've been through that. Okay? So, having wisdom of age now, you know, the crown of glory being upon my head, that, you know, the white hair, and, you know, I understand it now. And I know that as God blesses us, that every single one of you are like me, and that you are a sinful individual. You have sin within you. You have flesh that's crying out against you at times, and that you have the lust of the pride, the lust of the eyes, and lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And we're going to struggle. Somewhere along the line, there are going to be turmoils within the body. But when we get there, Lord willing, we never get there, but should we get there, and if we get there, and probably when we get there, that it should be handled in a what? Godly, righteous, biblical manner. Multiplication is always better than division. Does that make sense? Abraham looked toward multiplication. He didn't look for there to be the bloodshed and said, "You're right. This land can only handle one of us. May the strongest man win." Do you get it? But the sad thing is, in the United States, in many of our churches, that's how it's played out. May the strongest win, win. Well, Lot's decision. But ultimately, it was what? God's dominion. God is sovereign over all things. And here's my point. Even though Abram, we scratch our head and we go, what's the deal? I mean, Abram, how could you even make that offer to Lot? How could you even say to Lot, "So, the whole land is before us. You decide where you want. You want the left? I'll go to the right. You got the right? I'll go to the left." Abram had faith in God. He had faith in God's faithfulness to hold true to his promises. If Lot would have turned around and said, "I want this land right here," he wouldn't have said it. The heart of the king is in the hands of the Lord, and he turns to whichever way he chooses. Proverbs tells us that. I don't believe Lot could have ever decided to take in the land of promise from Abram. But he could have stayed within the land in just a different spot. Does that make sense? And it still ultimately would have been whose land? No, Abram's land. Abram would have had it by promise down as we go. Even though Lot may have lived in a part of that land somewhere else, he could have chosen to stay in the mountainous regions. He didn't have to follow the lusts of his eyes to go down to where he would have known, undoubtedly, the wickedness of Sodom, which we're going to transition to in a moment. I believe Lot knew when he chose to go down to the well-watered plains of Sodom and Gomorrah, the wickedness as well that he was going to be near. And he made a choice to enter into the world of worldliness, if you would, into the world of sin, for financial gain. What he thought was going to be good business-wise. And I want to challenge you in your own life to be careful of what you are willing to sacrifice on the altar of affluence. If it's the things of the world, the power, the prestige, the money that you want, those become your gods. And they will tear you down just as they have every other individual who's ever sought after false gods and false idols. And that's where we're going to transition to, where we see then the consequences of Lot's choice. Lot made a selection. He made a choice. And his choice was to follow the lust of his eyes rather than the truth of God. And so we have then the consequences. Well, what's the first consequence we see? Right after this time where Lot goes down in chapter 14, we see this coalition of kings who come in against Sodom and Gomorrah. We pick it up in chapter 14. Look at verse 1. I thought about having this section be our Bible reading this morning rather than chapter 18 and 19 there. But when I looked at all the names, I said, "No, I can't do that to Steve." And so, beginning of verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, the king of Shinar, Arioch, the king of Eliezer, Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Tatel, the king of nations, that they made war with Bera, the king of Sodom, Bersha, the king of Gomorrah, Shinab, the king of Admah, Shimeber, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. All these joined together in the valley of Sedom, that is, the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were allied, if you would, that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in the Ashtaroth Karnaim, in the Zuzim in Ham, in the Emim in the Sheva Kiriathaim, in the Horites in the mountain of Seir, and as far as El Paran, which is in the wilderness. Then they turned back and they came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites and all the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, that's five kings, went out and joined together in battle in the valley of Sidim against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, the king of nations, Amraphel, the king of Shinar, and Arioch, the king of Elasar. Four kings against five. Now that's five who are on the defensive, four that are on the offensive. The four that are on the offensive have now already gone through a large campaign. Okay, you'll see in a moment a map I've got here to how far they've traveled on this battle. Okay, and so you got five kings leaguing together to fight against four kings. Okay, and so verse 10. Now the valley of Sidim was full of asphalt pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Avram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Then one who had escaped came and told Avram the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, and the brother of Aner, and they were allies with Avram. Now when Avram heard his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born into his own house and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. So he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot in his goods, as well as the women and the people. Well, we have this capture of Sodom. So these kings come down and they attack all these cities. They attack Sodom and Gomorrah. They wind up then taking over not only the cities, but they also capture Lot and all that Lot has, and they take it with them. Well, word comes to Abram, and so Abram intercedes, if you would, intervenes on behalf of Lot. Now, the point I want to make here is these four kings, all right, who are going through this campaign, and again, we'll put up the map in just a moment here. When they're going through this campaign, how strong do you think they are? They're pretty strong. They're going against fortified cities, and they're making a rout of it all. Okay? And so you've got Chedorlaomer, and you got Tidal, and you got Arioch, and you got these other kings that are coming down, and so there are undoubtedly thousands in this army. Avram goes up against them with 318 of his own trained men, and then the men of Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner. Probably another couple hundred men. Probably less than 1,000. Maybe 1,000. But probably less than 1,000 men. They go up against this mighty, trained army. Here's the map. Now, in the purple to the right, you can see coming out of Damascus here. See if this works. You got the four kings coming down. And they're doing their battles here. And they bypass Sodom and Gomorrah in that area. Apparently, they must know they're going to hit them on the return trip, or maybe they decided at that point that that's when they were going to rebel. You know, in the 14th year, they decided to rebel against Chedorlaomer and his folks. And so maybe it might be that, you know, when they came past and they were coming back, that, you know, Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, and Zeboim, and all these guys, you know, the cities decided that, them, you know, maybe we can take them here, you know. It's been a long journey. Maybe we can take them. Well, guess what? They couldn't take them. Little side note. This map has Sodom and Gomorrah right in here. It is believed that they are... I'm going to get this wrong. It has them right on the outskirts. But there is, underneath the Salt Sea, which we call the Dead Sea, there's actually been found the ruins of a city. And so it's actually believed that Sodom and Gomorrah actually exist underneath the Dead Sea. In this little spot here, between the two, the waters fluctuate there a lot, and so this area here is a lot of times dry, and so it would have been very easy for that to have a city there, and God to have done something with an earthquake or whatever, da 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 da, and you know, kind of like what happened at Louisiana, New Orleans, you know, and flooded it, and they just didn't unflood it and try to rebuild it, anyways. But when the wise men leave from Mary and Joseph, they actually cut across right here. They come in this way, you know, coming down, but then they leave a different way, and they actually cut through the Dead Sea, because that part there is actually dried during the wintertime. There's not enough water. Anyways, and so, kind of an interesting thing. But anyways, so they come back, and they hit Sodom and Gomorrah, and then they continue on. Well, word comes then up to Avram, he's living up in the mountains, okay? Key word mountains there, think about that for later on. He's living up in the mountains, okay? And so he starts in pursuit of these guys. And he overtakes them way up here in Dan. This isn't just a couple miles, you know, they traveled 6 miles, they overtook them. You know, by foot, 6 miles is still a long way, especially when you're going through mountainous regions. No, they're already here. This is the Sea of Galilee. They're way up there at Dan, Mount Hermon. This is a long, long trip. So they're running. They've got to be double timing to try to catch these guys. And they travel the length of Israel to get there. Okay? You say, well, what's that mean? Think New Jersey. They started out in South Jersey and they went to North Jersey on foot in pursuit of these kings. Okay? So New Jersey may not be a large state, but I promise you, if you're hoofing it and you're walking even along the interstate, I-95, it's still a long way to go from South Jersey to North Jersey. Okay? And so these guys are doing all night. They're going through the night, and they overtake them up at Dan. Now, undoubtedly, the kings thought they were what? They were safe at this point, you know? And but here they are. They come, and they attack them at nighttime. They probably give them a surprise attack again. I think, though, they've traveled all night. I know they got pumped with adrenaline, but they've been traveling all night. They've got to be what? They've got to be tired by now. And yet they're going to attack them right there at nighttime. If they wait till the morning, the army's going to get up and move, right? And now they've got to travel again and try to catch them by surprise. It's not going to happen that way. So now here they are, after traveling all night, they've got to attack them with less than 1,000 guys. But with God, what? All things are possible. Again, Avram is trusting in the faithfulness of God. And so Avram puts everything on the table, and he goes in defense of Lot. And they capture it, and then we're told that in that ensuing battle, he chased them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. And so not only did they travel all the way to Dan, fight them, but then as all these kings, these powerful kings, are in retreat, Avram and his men continue to pursue them. Why? Because they want total victory. That's exactly right. They ultimately want Lot and his family back. And so they get it. Well, the sad thing is, and we're skipping parts here, but the sad thing is that you would think that after this, that Lot would kind of wake up a little bit. Maybe he chose what? Bad. Maybe he shouldn't have gone down to that area. Maybe he shouldn't have considered that. It didn't happen that way. In fact, Lot, seeing what happened, makes the decision not only to just not leave the plain, but Lot makes the decision to do what? To move into the city. To move into Sodom. Not only does Lot not only realize the error of his way, he pushes the error further. How many times is it when we see believers who other brothers or sisters, relatives in the Lord, are willing to intervene into their life to deliver them from whatever is holding them captive, whatever they have the lust toward, only to have that individual make the decision to what? Reject the intervention and go further into the sin of what you're struggling with. If you've ever been in the role of an intervener, if you would, being a part of an intervention, and that is a term that is used like with alcoholism and drug addictions and stuff like that, that you have interventions in these people's lives, and you watch the person go the other way, it's a heartbreaking thing. It's crushing. It makes you want to just quit. It's not worth the while. But praise God, Abraham didn't quit on Lot. Abram still loves Lot. How do I know that? Well, Lot's intent was, he goes back. Well, in chapter 18, which we looked at last week with the Abraham's encounter with Yahweh, there it is at the trees or plains of Mamre, right? He meets Yahweh, and Yahweh says to him as he's getting ready to leave, he says, "Should I hide from Abraham and what I'm about to do, since that, you know, it's through Abraham that I'm going to do all this stuff?" He says, "No, I shouldn't do that." So he lets Abraham know, "Listen, we're on our way to Sodom. The outcry against Sodom has come up against me, and I'm about to destroy it." Well, what do I know is the first thing that I see in this destruction of Sodom situation? I see again Abraham's intervention for Lot. We talked about this a little bit as we went through this. And that is that Abram, with boldness, goes before Yahweh, the King of the universe, who breathed the breath of life into him, who could snuff it out in a heartbeat. And he crawls out to God and he says, May the God of righteousness, and I want to say this right, because he pleads on what he declares to be Yahweh's characteristics. And he says to him, says, verse 23, Abraham came near and said, "Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city, would you also destroy the place in spirit, and not spirit, for the sake of 50 righteous that were in it?" Now listen to this. "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" What is Abraham really saying to God here? Do you really know what you're doing? And are you as righteous as you profess to be? According to whose standard? Abraham's. That's right. According to Abraham's standard. Abraham's already made the decision that if there's 50 righteous, for God to destroy the city because of the 50 would be unrighteous of God to do. And so the God of the universe, the judge of all the earth, clearly he could not be that unrighteous to destroy the cities because there were 50 righteous people in it. Now, I don't know how many people lived in Sodom and Gomorrah, but probably at least hundreds, if not thousands of people lived in that city. And so we're talking at this point, even a small percentage to begin with, okay? Well, then God says, no, for the sake of 50, I wouldn't do that, right? And so then we know that Abraham then comes back and he says, well, what about 45? Will you give me 40? How about 30? But what about 20? Oh, allow me to speak just one more time. Would you do it for the sake of 10? I think Abraham knew where he was heading on this one. I think Abraham was not intervening for Sodom for the sake of Sodom, though that was got the extended blessing within it, right? But Abraham knew that he had a relative living where? In Sodom. And he was intervening on behalf of his nephew Lot, in who I believe he thought would have been at least under the purview of his influence. And Abraham, I believe, stopped at 10 because he probably figured that Lot had at least 10 people under his influence who knew the Lord and served the Lord. We're going to talk about those 10 in just a moment here. Excuse me, Genesis 19. We read this as part of our reading, beginning in verse 8, and I'm going to skip a couple verses here. He says, Lot is saying now, he's brought the angels into his house, and the wicked men have come, and they want to bring the angels. They don't know they're angels. They think they're just men. They want to bring them out so they can know them carnally. Lot says, see now, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Now, that's key. I have two daughters who what? Virgins. They've not known a man. Important. So he's got two daughters in his house with him. And then we won't talk about what he said to do. I just always, that's again, it's one of these things, because in the end we're going to talk about one of these additional things to ponder is that righteous God, Lot was a righteous man, and I look at things like this and I go, ah! Anyways, I don't, there's things I don't understand and I'm not going to preach on because I can't go there. I just, it's like, man. Then the angels said to Lot, okay, this is later after they've blinded all these other guys and they're getting ready to cast them out. They've already made the determination what? There are not 10 righteous people here, right? God already knew. When God was agreeing with Abraham, he already knew. I mean, Abraham could have tried to negotiate all he wanted, but if he got down to the point where God's plan was going to be changed, he would have said, sorry, Abraham, that's not yours to come. But He could tell him, yes, Abraham, don't worry about it. For the sake of 10, I'd save it. Because he knew what? There wasn't 10. Well, then these angels say to him, says, have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in this city, take them out of this place. In other words, first they say, relatives. And then they say, whoever else you have here could be your what? Servants. Maybe he has some of his servants living in the city. Do you get it? Whoever else you have here, whoever's under your influence here in the city, go to them. Get them out of here. Okay? We will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of Yahweh, and Yahweh has sent us to destroy it. Verse 14. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters. Now this is key to me. Because they married his daughters. Does anybody know, you don't have to get graphic, how marriages were consummated? Why? What's the difference between someone being betrothed and someone being married? It was, they knew them. That's right, they had a relationship there. They had a physical relationship. And so, verse 8 would not be true. I have two daughters who have what? Not known a man. If these two were the same two, then they would have known what? A man. And they wouldn't be living with Lot. There are many people who say that these are fiancés. It doesn't say fiancés. These aren't the ones who are betrothed. These are the sons-in-laws who are married to them. I believe, and even if I'm wrong, we'll go there in a moment, but let's assume I'm right for a moment. You've got Lot and his wife. You've got two daughters living at home. You've got at least two daughters living in the city with husbands. You've now got what? 8. I wonder, do they have children themselves? Are there at least 2 grandchildren? Or maybe are there servants, but whatever. And I think that's what Abraham knew. I don't think that Lot and he separated and he never had anything to do with them. They probably sent telegrams and postcards to each other. I know they don't have those things, but you get what I'm saying. I'm sure they had fellowship with one another. And Uncle Avram probably was a close favorite to him. He was the only relative living near them, right? And so Uncle Avram probably would have known how many were in Lot's family. Even if these were fiancés, think about it. Doesn't God call us to be an influence upon our culture and upon our society? We haven't even gotten to those neighbors. We haven't even talked about other people who are shepherds as well, who may be living in the city, people that he has business dealings with. People that he had no influence over. Because, see, the next thing is Lot's influence, or should we say the lack thereof. Lot had no influence in his culture. Lot had no influence on his society that he lived in. In his community, sadly to say, as a whole, Lot had no influence in his family. Men, this is a message to you and to me. God is going to hold us accountable for the influence that we have in the lives of those we come in contact with. There are consequences to decisions that we make. And this is not the beat on us. I understand. I mean, I've got kids that are growing up. I don't always necessarily agree with all the decisions they make, as perfect as they are, because they're mine. But the reality is that for you that have the younger children, that you're still making decisions, this should really play into it. This is a serious decision that you make. For those of us who have already, we've passed one phase or whatever, one or the other, it doesn't mean that we stop and we quit, right? It just means what? I change the way I think at this point and I move in a different direction. Does that make sense? I'd love to tell you that Lot got it and that Lot changed the way he thought. But clearly, Lot didn't. And so we see that when these angels then say to him, we're in chapter 19 here, when the angels say that they're going to take them out, it says, verse 15 says, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry. He was what? He was dawdling. He wasn't willing to go. It's saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, meaning that there's potentially, again, daughters that aren't here, right? Your two daughters are here. Why did he say that? Well, because he had gone out that night and he had told the sons-in-law what was going to happen, and the sons-in-law thought he was what? He was a crackpot. It says that they thought he was joking, which means really they what? They laughed at him. They thought he was an idiot. Have you ever told your family the truth? Have you ever witnessed to them and had them almost laugh at you? Do you have relatives or friends or acquaintances who think that you're just kind of off the deep end because of a fanaticism for Jesus? Jesus tells us that because of our life for His name's sake, that we will be rejected amongst men. Not because of ourselves, but because of Him. If we never in our life ever run into people who think we're weird because we stand aloof from the world and the things that are in the world, then maybe we're too much of the world and people don't realize that there's a difference in us. That's a sad thing. Well, they grab him. They say, take your wife, your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, this is great, the men or the angels took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of the two daughters, Yahweh being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside. They dragged him. They dragged him. While they lingered, while they just kind of said, they know God is ready to do this, and yet they're still not leaving. And so God in His mercy instructs the angels, just drag them. I don't care how you get them out, drag them by their feet, drag them by their hair, drag them by their hands. They grab their hands and they yank them. Could you picture it? Could you picture the dragging them out the next morning if you were kind of out there in the city square? You see these two guys dragging these four people and they're dragging them out of the city. But no! Yahweh wants to deliver you for the sake of Avram. Now it doesn't say it here, but we read it later. For the sake of Avram, God was faithful in His faithfulness to Avram by saving Lot. Because ultimately, even though Avram prayed for 10, God knew what Abram was really praying for. He knew his heart. And Lot was spared, not because he willingly left the city, not because of his great influence, but Lot was spared because of Abram's faithfulness, or because of Yahweh's faithfulness to Abram. And we read about that in just a few verses. So they grab him, they take him out. But look at this. Look at this. The continuing then, not of just the influence, but his intentions as well. And so they come out of the city, and they tell them, verse 17, so it came to pass when they brought him outside, that he, that is the angel, said, escape for your life, do not look behind you, or nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape where? To the mountains. What do you think is the importance of this statement? Escape to the mountains? Yes, not just get a far away, it's where Abraham is. Go back to Abram. Go back to Abraham. Flee to the mountains. Get back to where you were supposed to be. Remember when Abram said to him, he said, you know, we're growing too large. Is not the whole land before you? Was he talking about the plains? No, he was talking about the mountains. That's where they were. And he said, if you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. What he's asking Lot is not to leave, to go into the world. He's asking him to hang out still, but stay in the mountains, but just what? Let's split a little bit here. Let's stay here in the will of God together, but find different areas that we can water our flocks. And so the angels are basically saying what? Go back to where you belong. But what does Lot respond? Don't make me do it. Don't force me there. I can't go there lest somebody slays me, lest something bad happens to me there. Why? Yeah, isn't it? Because once you have sinned and you are under conviction, where is the last place you want to go? Back to church. Why? Because you think the people are going to what? Hate you and they're going to judge you. What do you think Abram would have done if Lot showed up on his doorstep? I think we'd have seen the picture of the prodigal son. I think Abram would have seen him afar off and he would have ran out and he would have embraced him and said, welcome home. Look at all you've lost. You've lost everything. You had great herds, you had a wife, you had a bunch of kids, you had grandkids, and you went into the world and you lost it all. But welcome home. Sadly to say, Lot didn't play that role of the prodigal son at this point. Rather, he says what? Don't make me go back. Don't make me go there. What about this little city? It's an insignificant city, and that's why Zoar was called Zoar, because it was insignificant, it was little. He said, let me go there. In other words, don't make me leave the world. And they said, fine, just, we can't do anything until you're safe. Isn't that something? We can't do anything until you're safe. Even while Lot is still struggling in his sin. And so they're on the way, they say, but they tell him, but do this one thing you're not allowed to do, and that is what? Don't even look back. Don't even look back. But then we know that Lot's wife, what? Looks back. I believe it's not because she's missing Sodom, she's going to Zoar. I think she's missing her children and her grandchildren. And she looks back, and she's turned into salt. God's commandments are true. Whether we like it or not, God sets the rules, and we have to live by the rules. Many times God in His grace doesn't bring death upon us. The wages of sin is death. But if He wanted to, we could all be like Ananias and Sapphira, who are dropped dead because of the sin that they caused. We all could be like Nadab and Abihu, where the fire of God came out and consumed them. But God in His grace doesn't do that to us all the time. But He has pictures in His Word for us to look at for understanding His holiness, and that what God says to us is true, and His command is real. And He expects us to abide by them. Lot's wife turns into a pillar of salt. Lot and his daughters go to Zoar. But then they decide to do what? To go to the mountains. And we're not going to talk about that, because we see that when they went to the mountains, they didn't go to Abram. They decided to go into a cave to do their own thing. And their own thing led into greater sin. Two final little thoughts here. Lot chose another city rather than returning to the mountains. An amazing thing. What about you? Are you that person who's living in the plains, who's chosen the world rather than choosing the things of God? You desire to be in the world, but now you realize maybe it's not. Where are you going to go? Are you going to just try to go to a smaller city? Maybe just a little bit less sin? Or are you going to return to where God's got you? The second little thing here, again, that's really mind-boggling to me, and that is that Lot was called a righteous man three times. Three times Lot is called a righteous man. It says in 1 Peter 2, it says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and deliver them in the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, then verse 6 says, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterwards would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing the lawless deeds. I said these were two additional points to ponder that I'm not going to preach on, because I don't get it. This is one that I ponder on. This is one that I meditate on, that even in the midst of the mistakes that Lot made, there had to be a desire in his heart to serve the Lord, and God knew it. Does that make sense? And that in the end, even after he lost everything, because you know in the mountains, I mean, he lost his daughters in a sense, right? What his daughters did, and we won't go there. I mean, what did he have left? Nothing. And yet, in the final assessment, God calls Lot a righteous man. We do see Lot standing at the door. I can't understand the culture in which he lived. I put it down to culture. He was protecting hospitality. He was protecting the strangers that he had brought into his home. And he withstood. He withstood the perverted people of his day. And they said, you know, this man's trying to be our what? Our judge. So apparently Lot, at least within himself, was seeking to live a righteous life before God. He just didn't allow his light to shine. Live and let live. It's okay. Tolerance is a good thing. We'll just let the world do what they want to do, and I have my... Isn't that what the world wants to tell you? Have your faith, but have it to yourself. As long as it doesn't affect us, as long as it doesn't bleed over, we've got to be careful. God has given us His righteousness so that we can be ambassadors. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, we've been memorizing the sorted verses this month from it, right? We're called to be ambassadors of Christ, in order to reconcile men to him. But that it only is because he made him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might be the righteousness of God. Do you get it? And that righteousness is supposed to shine as ambassadors. We're supposed to be going out as ambassadors of Christ, not holding it to ourselves, not hiding it under the bushel, but letting it shine for others. So, how do you respond when there's troublesome times? Whether in the church, whether in your life, are you trusting in God, or do you act selfishly? Do you want what's best for you? Do you want for it to turn out the way you want it to turn out? Or do you want, like Jesus said in the Garden of Gethsemane, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus would have loved to have the cup passed from him. That's what he said. Mind-boggling. But he said, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. What are your primary determiners for decision-making? What are you basing your decision for this election on? Is it finances, world and national politics, or is it biblical principles? Are you going to vote for somebody just because you're of a certain political persuasion, and this is not a political message? I'm not saying who you should vote for, whatever. I'm just saying, are you seeking God's face? Are you looking at the Word of God? Or are you looking at economic factors? Are you looking at world politics? And here's the deal. I don't care who gets elected. It's not going to change the direction of this country if this country doesn't turn back to God. I don't care if it's a Democrat, I don't care if it's a Republican, I don't care if it's an independent. If those who are called by God's name, if His people who are called by His name, if they don't humble themselves, if we don't recognize our sin and our wickedness, and we don't turn from it, and we don't repent, and we don't call upon His name, we don't humble ourselves, we don't pray, this world, this country is not going to change. We keep looking at all the scabs and all the things that are on the flesh of this country, and we say, we got to have somebody who's going to change our finances. We got to have someone who's going to change the national debt. We got to have someone who's going to start being a friend to Israel. We got to have somebody who's going to... It's not going to change. I don't care. Because God is the one who will bless or curse the nation. And blesses the nation whose God is Yahweh, whose God is the Lord, and this nation... God is not Yahweh anymore. And until this nation turns, God will not turn His face back. Read Romans chapter 1. We're right in the middle of it. And people don't like to hear that. I'm an American. I served 11 years. I die for my country. But I'm a realist. And I'm a biblicist. And I see what God says in His Word, and I hold it to be true, regardless of my allegiances here on the earth. I'm a citizen of His kingdom, above beyond the citizen of this kingdom. And until we, who are called by His name, choose to allow our lights to shine and choose to allow our righteousness to be revealed and have an effect upon our society and not live and let live, guess what? It's not going to change. What risk are you willing to put yourself to intervene for your loved ones? Intervene for this country. What is your spiritual influence like? If the fate of Augusta, or wherever you live, was on your shoulders, would it survive? If Abraham was praying for Augusta, for the CSRA, whatever, and you were Lot, would there be 10? Would there be 10 because of your influence? Now, I know some of you got a lot of kids, right? And you say, well, you know, but even you with 7, I got 7. There's only Marsh and I, that's only what? We're still one short, and that's assuming that we even have those. But apparently, his daughters who were married to the sons-in-law did what? They stayed. They stayed as well. Do you get it? And so, and we know that what happened with the daughters in the mountains. If it was up to me, it was dependent upon me, what would be the future of this city? What would be the future of this country? Let's pray. Father, I thank You that it's not up to me. I thank You that You are God over all, and that it's Your grace, it's Your mercy, which You have revealed unto all men. You desire all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of truth. You are not only the propitiation for my sins, but You're also the propitiation for the sins of the whole world. And that You are long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to the knowledge of truth, that all should repent. God, I pray that I would be bold, that I would be faithful as Abraham, that I would be willing to intervene physically and intervene spiritually on behalf of those in this world. Not only my own loved ones, especially my loved ones, but even those that are in this world, Lord. My neighbors, those in my community. Lord, I pray that we would be like cities that are set upon a hill whose light cannot be hid. God, I pray that you will cause this little band of believers to be of great power, to be of great influence in this community. Lord, I pray for Devin as he's out today ministering on your behalf. Lord, as he enters into Satan's realm weekly, as he fights against those heavenly hosts, Lord, that you will empower and strengthen him. Lord, that as he gets the opportunity to speak to middle school and high school students, that he will be able to proclaim the true form of deliverance. But God, I pray that as you have placed each of us as well into our own areas of ministry, our own lands of ambassadorship, that you would cause us to be faithful, to remember which kingdom we should have the greater allegiance to, and that we would be willing to open our mouth. Lord, I pray that you would help us not to follow in the steps of Lot in his choosing the things of the world rather than the things of God. That we would desire to train up our children in your truth and your love. Lord, I pray that you protect our children as they look to the plains of Sodom with the allurement that's there, ignoring the traps that are waiting for them. Lord, that they would not act as presumptuous as Lot, and they would desire to stay within the promised land. I pray that you would be exalted, Lord, in all things, for you alone are God. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.